Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I will be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no-how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right, happy Turkey Day, happy Thanksgiving Day. And today our jump-off topic is, and we can talk about anything you guys want to talk about, because there's plenty of trending topics. Our jump-off topic is the 1% hunger and homelessness, and this is the week of Thanksgiving week is, I believe, Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week. It's Thursday, so we'll talk about it. That's our jump-off topic. We're going to go to the phone lines here right after this.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Follow me.
Well, if you were asleep, I hope you're awake now. So the cult of personality by In Living Color. Okay, all right, our jump-off talk before we go to the phones is the 1% hunger, and this is Hunger and Homelessness, I believe, Awareness Week. You can look that up online. And today, in the United States, in various areas around the world where you might have an American present, it's Thanksgiving Day. So the traditional American Thanksgiving dinner will probably have turkey, some type of, you know, hot cross rolls or biscuits or something. Candy yams, macaroni and cheese. But it, you know what? It's sort of like it could be different anywhere you go. But it seems like the turkey, the bird, is the central piece. But I did that so many times. I try not to do a traditional Thanksgiving. But anyway, on that note, so that's what today is, Thanksgiving. And it's a long holiday for many people as well. Some people probably took the whole week off starting that Monday, or even left Sunday. But a lot of people, it was a heavy travel day yesterday, and it'll be probably a heavy travel day Sunday here in the United States for those who are traveling to relatives and this, that, or the other. Some people are cooking, are preparing the dinner now. It's 10:48 a.m. Eastern Standard Time where I'm at. But some people are in the kitchen right now preparing for dinner that might be served 4, 5, 6 hours from now. All right. I don't know if they have, I guess they have parades in New York or wherever, because I haven't been into that thing like ever, but I think Macy's used to have, I don't know if they still do. But anyway, that's, you know, stuff yourself, watch the ball game or eat and go to sleep. So that's what happens to a lot of people today. Anyway, and then tomorrow is the second largest shopping day on the planet. This is the largest shopping day, or biggest shopping day in the United States, but the second largest shopping day on the planet. Number one is Singles Day, which happened last month on November 11th, and that's in China, and where people get on their smartphones, and I mean farmers, you name it, people that are selling houses, farmers, people that might be selling cars, anything you can think of, people get on their smartphones in China, and that's it. Singles Day dwarfs Black Friday, but that was last month. This month, tomorrow, Black Friday, I do not go out on the highways or the streets on Black Friday. It's just too much traffic. But that's for me. Okay, now, I'll jump off topic before we go to the phone lines here. We'll be, Chris suggested yesterday, we're going to do it, hunger and homelessness. We're going to cover that. But I was listening to a video of Kanye West this morning, and he mentioned something about the 1%, the 1% that controls the 99%. So what he's into or getting into, he mentioned that, now here are the five basics that he says that the 1% control: food, water, shelter, education, and medicine. Okay, those are the five that Kanye said that the 1% control the 99%. Once again, he said food, water, shelter, education, and medical needs. Now, I've added on to that. I've added on transportation, mass communication, clothes, and sanitation. All right, so for those of us who want to do like little communities, you know, that's food for thought. Dream, hope, Habitat, which we will have on here in a few minutes. I think, well, that covers shelter. It covers food. And I guess you can throw water in there, too. But, you know, when we open up their mics, we'll get to that. So let's go to the phone lines. Hold if I can find my studio. Okay. Let's go to the phone lines real quick here. Area code 410, your mic is open.
Hey, peace and blessings, peace and blessings. Can you hear me good?
Yes, sir, we can.
Man, I'm so excited about everything. I'm just grateful today that I made another Thanksgiving. That's the whole goal, is being grateful every single moment, knowing that at any moment you could be homeless. And that's what we're fighting for the homeless, to be able to provide real jobs, real solutions, you know, because everyone is just one way, one wrong decision, one wrong job, one wrong turn, hurt your ankle, and you miss 2 months of rent, and now you're homeless. And I'm just here to say I'm grateful, finding things to be grateful about, that I do have a roof over my head, but we also have a program to help people. And I'm just grateful, man. That's what I want the viewers to know, to be grateful regardless what's going on, regardless what you see, regardless what you feel, regardless how bad it looks. You can move. You got your brains just one yes away, and you can make it. Just be grateful.
All right. Well, it's good to hear that. I'm going to leave your mic open. Let's go to 309 area code. Your mic is open.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. And hi, Anthony. Nice to hear your voice. That's my man in Miami. I think he's in Orlando for the day with his family. But, no, I'm blessed to be here, and I look forward to, you know, having these topics. And, you know, if you look at 1%, they're going to control the 99%. You know, what can we do? So, you know, I stepped out to that 1%ers, and I started making partnerships with them so that I can give back to you as you give back to the community. And you're still making them money. So it's a win-win on their end, and it's a double, triple win on our end. So we do have that to discuss. There's many ways that these companies, you know, they don't pay taxes. And they make all the money, but what they do is reinvest it to make more money off of you instead of paying it in and doing their fair share. So we need to figure out how can we make it fair for everyone, and that's equality. And that's going to the 17 things that the United Nations wants to address. And I love this show because we went over the 17 yesterday. And we were able to go all the way down to number 17 just in our conversation right here. You know, to me, that's amazing because here we're sitting here over 2 hours and they've been sitting here over two decades trying to figure it out. But what it takes is it takes you and I to have conversations like this, come together and be the change we want to see and make a difference in people's lives that we've never met, but doesn't mean that we won't meet. But we do need to stop with the greed and fix the need.
I agree. Chris, in your opinion, how can if a person is – let me paint a picture using a chessboard. Chessboard's got – so people visualize that. Chessboard, matter of fact, one of the first things at winning the game of chess – is knowing the chessboard. Now, I call that knowing the landscape. So the landscape of the chessboard and some grandmasters of chess, and they have videos on this, they can play multiple people blindfolded and win the game. And the primary reason for that is because the first fundamental thing they learn that we all must learn is the landscape. So I'm going to use the chess analogy, and then I'm going to bring it into how we can so we can look at the 1% and 99%. So the chessboard has 67 squares, 67 spaces. That's the landscape. All right. Here in the United States, 86% of the population of the United States lives on 3% of the available landmass. So if you take 3% on the chessboard, that equals about 4 squares. 4 out of 67 total squares on the board. So that's where 86% of the population of the United States is. 92% of the black population in the United States lives within you can narrow that down to like 1 square. All right. That's what, now those 4 squares, which represents 3% of the total landmass, because they're about, I think, 22% of the United States is wilderness, which means man hasn't even set foot. This country's over 200 years old. There are places in the United States where man has not even set foot in yet. So anything outside of those 4 squares is basically rural mixed in with some wilderness. The United States is a rural country. All right. Now, if you're struggling within those 4 squares, and the 4 squares, okay, where you have, because we have, that's over 320 million people packed in. Well, hold it. Let me back that up. You got, let's say, 300 million people. Now, let's bring it down to, let's say, at least 200 to 250 million people are crammed into those 4 squares out of a total of 67. So when you have that many people crammed in that smaller space, that, you know, supply and demand, competition, you know, and then people have to make rules to protect their little piece of the pie within those 4 squares. That's when we get redlining and all these regulations, government regulations, okay? So now, if you want to escape that, I call those 4 squares the matrix. If you want to escape that, it's relatively easy to do if you can get your head straight, all right? Because it's all really mental and psychological. And if you step outside of those 4 squares, and that might require you to drive 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, a spot that you want to go to. But you go to those places where there is, matter of fact, there was one gentleman, he's been on here about twice this week. He went to a place, he went to Belize. He was able to buy 100 acres of land where he can basically do what he wants to do. Then you have people, there was another gentleman that called earlier this week. He's got land, I guess farmland, in I think Wisconsin and Mississippi. So in those places, you can start to enter into the 1% club. Because in those places, more than likely you're not going to get municipal water, which is controlled by a local government. But if you know how to drill a well or dig for a well or know how to harvest rainwater, then you can control your own water. You don't have to go buy bottled water, Fiji, Deer Park, or whatever they have in the store now. If you learn how to grow your own food or partner with people that grow their own food. So, Chris, I'm going to have you chime in on that. How can a person start to take control or enter into their own 1%, getting off the grid?
Well, if people actually looked at the money they spend on a daily basis, you know, how much of it's going to the 1%? And you know, I don't know if you guys have ever been paid to go to Amazon, Walmart, Starbucks, but we were able to put an app together that gets you up to 20%. It's 15% plus it's stackable. So if you have a Chase bank account, you're getting 3 to 5 out of that. And you get 15% back for going to shop at Kohl's, and then you got your Kohl's card and you're getting another reward. You can make that your payment source through this app. And you get the rewards, you get cash back in a rebate, but you get to choose how much of it you give back. So that's one way that you can reach into the 1%. Now, electric and gas. 17 states, we become an independent business owner as an entity to lock down people's bills, keep the bills from rising, because I know that every person across the country, your electric and the world, because the UK is going up unbelievable. And we have 26 countries and 17 states, but the UK is one of them. And if we can lock those people's bills in and not make them pay more money than what they would normally pay because of the way the inflation of greed is happening with this, we can turn 20% of that. So if you're spending $100 a month in an electric bill, $20 of that will go toward your children, prison programs, and job creation and getting these people the services and what they need. And that would make it what everybody would want, right? It's not about just what I want. You know, it's about the collective of what we all want. But if we stand together, these businesses will follow because you are their consumer. But we just need to have that one common goal, and, you know, it's about helping the need over the greed, because greed is always going to be there until we're able to work with our children's children. So the kids that are kids now, it's the kids that are being born, and from this point forward, that don't need to see anger. They don't need to see stress over not being able to pay a bill. I'd rather you have a great paying job. We could create millions of jobs right now. It's up to you. All you have to do is tell me where your problems are, and we start to attack them by not violently. We do this in a nonviolent, a constructive, reconstructive way. And what it takes is the palm of your hand. It don't take your mouth to say what's always on your mind to hurt someone's feelings. It don't take your eyes to scowl at somebody. It takes a smile, and it takes less muscles to do that than it does to frown. So people that are in a bad, lethargic mood when you wake up in the morning, put on something positive, listen to it, so that you can set yourself up for a positive day. But look at what is out there and what you don't know about by maybe asking a few questions, thinking about how can we turn this around. I've been trying this for many, many, many years. I've been doing it 17 years. But over the past 4 or 5 years, I've been able to figure out these niche things, and I've partnered with almost 300 Fortune 500 companies for your benefit, to help your kids and help your communities grow without asking you for a dollar. You're already spending your dollar. You're already buying their products. But if you're going to get what you want, why don't you help a need? And I think this will be the way to kind of step in on that 1%.
Great, great. Now, I'm putting out a call of action. Thanksgiving Day 2022. So we're talking today. But I'm planting a mustard seed during this podcast right now, where by this time next year, 2023, instead of just having a live stream where we're having a conversation, we shall be, I don't know how many locations we'll have be in, because there are a lot of people listening to this live stream, but hopefully we'll be building dream habitat or hope dream habitat structures, so a person who might be homeless that morning, by the time the sun goes down, they will have a structure that they would have participated in help building. By the time sundown goes down on this day, a year from now, same day a year from now, and they'll be growing. I mean, well, they have to plan it out. I'm just planting the mustard seed. Carlos, are you there?
I'm here, sir. How are you doing, L.A.?
Fine. Happy Thanksgiving. All right, well, Dream Habitat, I'm pretty sure we there's enough people out there in a lot of places where we can scale. What are some of the benefits of a Dream Habitat structure for individuals?
Yeah. First of all, I want to thank Chris for bringing his incredible skill, energy, enthusiasm, perseverance towards this problem. He's been boots on the ground for many, many years addressing this issue and specifically how to build affordable housing for people that need it, that can withstand hurricanes, floods, et cetera. He showed me a picture of a house that he built that was a replacement for a house that used to be there, I believe, before Katrina. And what Chris is doing, which is very interesting to our project, Dream Habitat, which is now Hope for Dream Habitat, as we've partnered, is that his manufacturing technology can build our houses and greenhouses that also grow fish, plants, and mushrooms for the inhabitants. So we've designed, I've got a greenhouse in my backyard that I made from a 10 by 20 carport that I've been growing fish, plants, and mushrooms in for, fish and plants for 11 years, mushrooms for the last 5 or 6 years. And it's an integrated system that combines the aquaponics, which is the fish provide water for the plants, and the plants produce, or the plants clean the water for the fish. So that's the fish-plant loop. But we've also added a mushroom fish loop where the fish waters the substrate for the mushrooms, and then the mushrooms clean the water for the pond. So we have plants and mushrooms cleaning the water for the fish pond, and the fish pond keeping the plants and the mushrooms healthy. And this way we're able to provide in a very small structure a way of growing fish, plants, and mushrooms to feed your family. And just to give you an idea of them, I'm running channel catfish. I recommend running local fish species because that way they're used to the climate. You don't have to worry about heating or cooling the water, et cetera. So I run channel catfish here in Virginia. As far as plants, I can grow anything. My grow beds are 30 gallons, so I can grow trees in it. I've grown moringa trees. I've grown miniature banana trees. Right now I'm growing a Duca Cava tree, which is a tree that grows these little grape-like fruits all over its bark. It's a little bonsai tree, which is also kind of cute. It's actually a six-year-old tree, but it's only about 12 inches tall. And it'll probably get maybe, I don't know, a couple of feet tall and start producing fruit. But after I built this greenhouse, I realized what an incredible gift it is to be able to go and grow your own food, but more importantly, connect back with nature, because I go in my greenhouse, I see the mint plants nice and green, I see the fish swimming around happily, I see the plants growing, I see the mushrooms growing, and I can tell that everything is in harmony along with myself. And I knew that some other human would want to experience what I'm experiencing, as a hobby or for survival, because these greenhouses can also be configured to maximize fish, plant, and mushroom production. Right now, my greenhouse is maximized for pleasure. I have a room where I can go sit. It's not set up to maximize the food production. it's more of a hobby greenhouse where I can go in, grow some fish plants and mushrooms and meditate and, you know, enjoy nature. So the combination of what Chris has done with his steel frame construction, where he can build houses literally in 2 hours, the frames, and then, you know, add all the drywall and everything, his technology can easily be adapted to build what we've designed, which are passive solar structures, which means they don't require any heating or cooling. They use the sun's natural energy to keep the structure warm and cold, well, warm in the winter, cold in the summer. And his technology is enabling us now to be able to house and feed the homeless. And as soon as you add the food component, you also add a mental component where now people can start, you know, they're using gardening for PTSD, for people with depression, for all sorts of things, not to mention teaching our children how to get connected back with nature, how to take care of fish plants and mushrooms, and how to, how to start leading a more sustainable life. And I'll end with that, unless you have any other questions.
How long, Carlos, the brand of mushrooms that you grow, how long does it take to grow those ready for harvest?
That's a great question. The mushroom life cycle is made up of a few stages. The first stage is the colonization stage, where the substrate gets colonized. And the substrate is what the mushroom mycelium, which is the, you know, the heart of the mushroom, the soul, the body. Well, actually, yeah, I'll explain a little bit later. But anyways, the mycelium is what spreads underground, and the mushrooms pop up from the mycelium above ground. And the mushrooms produce spores, and the spores produce more mushrooms. So that's the life cycle of the mushroom. The mycelium grows underground and decomposes wood, soil. It's a decomposer, depending on the mushroom type. And it decomposes material. That's where the function. Mushrooms are very, very important to nature because they're the ones that convert wood to soil. You know, so in the forest, when you go in the forest, you'll see mushrooms growing on trees. Well, they're decomposing those trees, converting it into biologically rich soil. So the substrate part of it is the part where the substrate is getting colonized with the mycelium. And I use straw or just yard waste. I use yard waste. I use straw, hay, all sorts of stuff. The mushrooms are very resilient on the growing medium. So the mycelium spreads on the medium and colonizes it. And that takes, it depends on your ratio of mycelium to straw. In other words, you inoculate the straw with chunks of mycelium, and then the chunks of mycelium start spreading. And it's really beautiful. It's like a white, it's pure white, and it looks like snow. And it ends up spreading all over the straw and turns it completely white, like a fluffy white. And that depends on your ratio of how much inoculant you put to the substrate. But typically I put about, 5%. So let's say you have, a 1 pound chunk of, or 1 pound of sawdust or straw. If you take 5% of that, so let's say 100 pounds, so then you have 5 pounds of inoculant. In my system, it'll take probably a couple of months to to fully colonize. Now, of course, if I increase the level of inoculant, it'll happen way faster, right? So the way I do it, it probably takes about a month or two, completely convert it white. And then after that, it's just a matter of days or weeks before the mushrooms start popping up. And it's all a function of temperature and humidity. So you have to make sure you have the right temperature and the right humidity. So typically within about a month to 2 month cycle, you can have mushrooms popping out every, and if you stage them properly, I have three grow beds in the back.
Yeah.
I can stage it where one bed is being colonized while the other one is mid-colonized while the other one is fruiting. Once the fruiting one is done, the worms come in and convert it to soil. And then what I do is I add wood chips and I add a different type of mushroom. Like I start usually with oyster mushrooms. They're a gourmet mushroom. You don't see them in the stores because they have a very short shelf life. So once the oyster mushrooms are done, I've got soil. I add wood chips, and now I start growing wine cap mushrooms, which is another type of mushroom that prefers a different type of media. And then once the wine caps are done, I've got half of a 30-gallon tote full of biologically rich soil full of worms, because the worms the whole time are kind of munching away, right? So they're producing soil. The mushrooms are decomposing wood. The mushrooms are producing fruit. You know, now you're building soil within one of those grow beds, which now I take out and use it in my backyard to grow other things. I had a tree, a little bush that was dying. I added some of my soil to it with the worms and everything in it, the mushroom compost, the worms, and that bush immediately came back to life, because you're talking about super biologically rich soil full of worms and nutrients and bugs and all that stuff. So it's very healthy for plants. And then what I do is I start the cycle over in that one, right? Meanwhile, the other one is fruiting. And just to give you an idea of how prolific mushrooms are, 1 square foot of mushroom production area will yield 10 pounds of mushrooms per week. Now, for you, for those of you that have eaten mushrooms, 10 pounds is a lot, okay? 2 pounds, like, just to give you an idea, 2 pounds of oyster mushrooms fills a gigantic bowl the size of, as big as a football and probably twice as tall. Okay, so 2 pounds, when I harvest 2 pounds of mushrooms, we can't eat it all in one day. You know, it's enough for like 3-4 days of meals. So the mushrooms are really the key. I was trying to design a structure that could feed one human all year round, everything they need. And I think I can do it in a 10 by 20 area that also grows the food in that 10 by 20 area. In fact, I want to do an experiment. I want to, you know, this is something I've been wanting to do. Once we start building the commercial, the legit version, the one I have in my backyard, the do-it-yourself version. But once we start building a version, you know, using Chris Collins' metal framing, I would like to do a video where I live in it for a month, 100% from the greenhouse or the house that feeds you. And I just want to see if I can do it in a way where I've got constant microgreens, you know, mushrooms going. The fish are the longer loop, right? So you've got the plant loop is a fast loop. The mushroom loop is a relatively fast loop. And the fish is a relatively slow loop, you know, for you know, channel catfish to go from, you know, fry to say, well, they'll grow as big as the – one thing about channel cats, they keep growing. They'll grow as big as the container. You know, I had a 22-inch channel cat growing in my 300-gallon fish pond, you know, and you can imagine that's a big fish in a little pond. It took him, to get to 22 inches, it was like 5 years that I had those channel cats in my tank. Now, of course, if you feed them more, et cetera, you can get them grow faster. But I think typically for the channel cats, you're probably looking at around, and if there's any fish experts on the line, they could probably correct me, because I'm not a fish expert. I'm an electrical engineer, so I've been dabbling in raising fish and plants and mushrooms. But I think the catfish have around a six-month cycle or so. So, you know, you're talking about plants constantly, mushrooms on about a 1 to 2 to 3 month cycle max, and then you've got the fish on about a 6 month cycle. And if you stage it properly, you can probably, you know, eat a little bit of fish. You know, you're not going to be eating fish all the time. You're probably going to be eating mostly mushrooms and microgreens most of the time, which, by the way, That's how vegans survive. You know, so you can live right on just on mushrooms and microgreens. And then occasionally, you know, every 6 months or so, you'll have some fish. But of course, you're producing, which means you can dehydrate, you can can, you can dry. So in other words, you can also start storing food, you know, because I'll tell you, you're going to grow more mushrooms than you can eat. So you need to dry them or dehydrate them. Same with the plants, you know, and the fish. So eventually you can start having a stockpile of food coming from this greenhouse so that now eventually you could just eat just from everything that you grew. And I'll land with that. Thank you.
All right. Well, we can start getting our menu together for the next holiday season, Thanksgiving and Christmas. All right, microgreens, mushrooms, of course, they're different varieties of, you got what, button cap, shiitake, portobello mushrooms. Because mushrooms don't have seeds, if I'm correct. They don't have seeds, right?
Yeah, but, you know, be careful when people sell you mushroom seeds. It's a big scam. So anybody that's listening, if you see anything on Etsy, whatever, for mushroom seeds, it's usually a ripoff. There's legit companies that sell you real mushroom stuff, you know, so you can grow. But, yeah, there's a infinite variety of gourmet mushrooms that you can grow. Of course, there's also the medicinal mushrooms. You've got your reishi, you know, shiitake, of cordyceps. There's a bunch of medicinal mushrooms that you can grow. Of course, psilocybin, which has now been legalized in Colorado and Washington, I believe. Psilocybin is being used to treat depression, alcoholism, PTSD. So, you know, to me, the mushrooms are the star of the show. I really think that they're the key. In fact, I know vegan restaurants here in Washington, D.C. When I took my mushrooms, you know, because you can sell these mushrooms locally to restaurants for $10-$15 a pound because they're gourmet mushrooms. I took some mushrooms down, and I was talking to a vegan restaurant. They said, we want your mushrooms, but you got to guarantee me 60 pounds per day. You know, that's a good problem to have, right? You know, you're talking 60 pounds. Times $10 to $15 a pound. So you know, when we're talking about these tiny greenhouses for the homeless that house and feed the homeless, we're also talking about creating businesses and jobs for them. Because now, you know, the first thing they need is they need an address and a place to take a shower. Right? We need hygiene. You know that makes you feel good about yourself. And I've been homeless before, and I'll tell you. You know, the showering part is important, you know, so you can feel clean. Having clothes, you know, why do we give away clothes why do we have clothing drives? Well, because having a shower and clothes gives you dignity. You know, you can walk around with some dignity. So the shower is super important and the clothing, of course. So now once we've added hygiene, we include food growing. And once you add the food growing, now you're adding the mental components of the stress relief, the food, and also the pride that comes from growing your own food. I don't know how many listeners out there have grown their own food, but I will tell you, when you harvest your own tomato, when you harvest your own mushroom, when you harvest your own fish, it's very, very spiritual. You actually appreciate the food because you've grown it yourself. And also, it tastes better than the food that you buy at the grocery store. And there's a reason for that. Because in your little greenhouse, the tomatoes are naturally ripening. In your little greenhouse, the fish are happy. In your little greenhouse, the mushrooms are happy. So now you're producing food that's very, very healthy because it's got all the nutrients and it hasn't been picked early, you know, in order to make it to the shelf. Most of the produce that we get, unfortunately, is not very nutrient dense because of the fact that it's being mass farmed and mass produced and grown with you know, grown in ways that aren't really sustainable. And when you grow food this way, everything tastes 1,000% better. So yeah, it you know, what Chris and I are doing really is, you know, it's an incredible solution really all the way around. Thank you, LA.
Well, Carlos, I hope you something in your backstory here. I'm fascinated by. Now, you said you were homeless at one time. So how did you go from homeless? And I mean, were you like Steve Harvey homeless, living out of your car? He lived in a car for like 3 years. So how did you go from homelessness to Dream Habitat?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I need to bring in the military because I joined the Air Force when I turned 17. I went in the delayed entry program. My parents were immigrants, so we didn't have a lot of money. You know, I've been working full time since I was 16 years old, even during high school. So, you know, I wanted, you know, the military is a way to get out of the house, right? I've always been independent. So I wanted to see the world. You know, I wanted to, and I didn't have a job. I was working at the Metro, actually. I helped build the D.C. Metro, believe it or not. I was out there, building, you know, some of the lines that were built, you know, running jackhammers and things like that. So I actually had a good job. It was a union job, so I was getting paid relatively good money for a high school kid, you know, and everything's relative, right? You know, back then I was like, if I could only make 10 bucks an hour, I'll be rich, you know, because the minimum wage was like $4 an hour. So I was working for the DC Metro and I was making like $7 an hour, which was really good. And I was living at home, no rent. So I was doing very well, but I had signed up for the Air Force and I'm a person of honor. You know, if I tell you I'm going to do something, I either do it or I'm dead. You know, that's the way I look at things. My word is my bond. So anyways, I went in the Air Force, and then when I got out, the Air Force is like your mom, right? Well, I had no mom all of a sudden, and it was the hardest decision of my life to stay in California on my own, no job, nothing, or to go back and move in with my parents again at 20. You know, by the time I got to the Air Force, I was in my 20s. And I chose, you know, I took the harder route. I said, you know what? I'm gonna survive. I'm gonna stay out here and survive. And I started doing any job I could. I took construction jobs. I flipped burgers. You know, I did everything. But you know, as people know, sometimes in life things just happen. You know, where you find yourself. I was going to Riverside City. I was going to the community college at the time. And actually, I was going. I don't think I was even at the university yet. I think I was still at the community college level. And I was a broke student, you know, no money, no job, in California, no place to live. And, you know, I started taking odd jobs. Like I worked doing construction, you know, flipping burgers, whatever job I could take pretty much, you know. And I started finding these rental to share opportunities, which some of you may be familiar with. And that's where you go in and you live in somebody's house and you pay a percentage of their rent, you know, the lease. It's called a rental to share. So I was doing rental to shares. And then what happened was my rental to share ended all of a sudden. And I found myself without a job and without a house. I had a car. So I lived out of my car for about 2 months or so. And I relied mostly on friends. I had some friends. I was in Hacienda Heights, California, by the way, just to give you some background. I was living in Hacienda Heights, California.
Now, what part of California is that in? North, south, central?
That's Southern California. Hacienda Heights, it's not quite south central, but it's not, you know, it's the pre-hood. I don't know how else to put it, but it's.
Is that in Los Angeles County?
Yeah, Los Angeles County. We're not talking Beverly Hills, you know. We're talking suburbs.
Right.
Yeah, it's all suburbs, right? I mean, L.A. is one big, gigantic suburb. But yeah, South Central is probably an hour from where I was or so. But yeah, so I was living in Hacienda Heights, and you know, I found myself homeless, you know. So friends of mine, you know, I had a friend of mine that was letting me crash in his garage as long as his parents couldn't catch me. You know, like they would kick me out of the garage if they saw me sleeping in there. He would sneak me some food, you know, from his parents' house. And I had no money. You know, I had no money, no food, no food stamps. I had my car. So getting gas was probably the most important thing, was just, you know, finding money for gas. And I was sleeping in the park. There was a park in my neighborhood. It's actually kind of not – well, I think it's kind of funny now that I think about it. I would park my car in the parking lot, and there was this rocket. It was made of metal, and it was like, you know, this, you know, these rockets that kids can climb on, you know, like a jungle gym. And it had several stories, had like a bottom floor and a top floor. And it wasn't very big around. It was maybe like, I don't know, 6 feet in circumference, you know. And I would climb up on top of the top floor of the rocket with my sleeping bag, and that's where I would sleep. Of course, you know, the park police would come by and they would kick me out, you know, and I'd have to go into my car and drive around or whatever. But yeah, you know, I've experienced homelessness, and I'm also a vet. So I know right now we've got homeless vets here. You know, I live in Falls Church, Virginia now. I drive 7 miles and there's homeless vets right now. So, you know, to keep going, you know, this whole time I was studying to be an electrical engineer. So I was a student, you know, during this whole
entire period. That takes a lot of concentration for that major.
Yeah. Electronics engineering is one of the hardest disciplines in engineering. Just to give you an idea, you know, just to get to engineering, you got to take physics, calculus, chemistry, you know, electromagnetics, advanced math. That's just the prerequisite. That's like the first 2 years you're doing nothing but that stuff. Finally, if you can make it through that, then you start your electronics stuff. And of course, that can get very, very complex. So it took me 7 years to get my 4-year degree. And that's because I intentionally graduated high school with straight D's. You know, I was going to get out of high school and become a millionaire and save the world, you know. And then I got out into life and realized that life isn't really that easy or that simple. So, you know, little by little, I started getting my credits. And then, you know, I have to mention this because this is an important part of my life. I was ready to take my life. I was at a point, you know, after this, I had gotten involved in drugs. And I was in a very, I had gotten myself kicked out of, I had gotten admitted into Cal Poly Pomona as an electrical engineer. I had done a year as an electrical engineer. And then I started backsliding. I got involved in drugs and ended up getting kicked out of Cal Poly Pomona. I was actually, they said that I was suspended. And they told me that I had to go back to community college and raise my GPA above 3.2 so that I can get back into the engineering program, because I let my GPA drop, you know, below that. And at the same time, I had applied at General Dynamics in Pomona. They build missiles. And they had a program where they would pay you to go to college. It's called the co-op program, COO co-op. And what they did is they paid your college, plus they gave you a salary. And I'm talking big bucks, like, you know, $22,000. And this is just to give you a time frame. Just now, you know, it's nothing. But back then, you know, we're talking, gosh, 82-ish or so. You know, they were offering me $22,000 a year, plus paying for school. Plus, every credit that I handed in over a B, they would give me $1,000. So if I was taking 12 credits and I got 12 Bs, they would give me $12,000. So I had this offer from General Dynamics, but it was contingent on me being an engineer, you know, being at Cal Poly. Would have gotten myself kicked out of. And even worse, you know, that night, well, I had an interview that morning. That night, I went out and partied. And I was with some friends and drinking, and I got in a fight. My background is martial arts, so I've been in a lot of fights, but unfortunately, I seem to attract fights. And I got in a fight with this wrestler, and during the fight, he came in for a double leg takedown, and I had no jiu-jitsu at the time. I had no ground game, so, you know, he came in for a double leg. I kicked him in the head, but it didn't even faze him. He came in for a double leg, got me on the ground, but when he hit me with the double leg takedown, he dislocated my right knee because that knee had been dislocated about seven times. I used to do martial arts, and I dislocated my knee, and I kept doing it, and it would pop in and out every once in a while, you know. And when he did the double leg, he dislocated my knee. So I'm on the ground, and he's trying to smash my head against the ground, and I'm just thinking about my knee because it hurt really bad. And I don't want to get too graphic, but I'm sitting there trying to fight the dude, and he's got the better of me. He's full mount, you know, trying to smash my head against the ground. And this girl that I was with comes by and scratches him across the face with her nails and gets the dude off of me. So this is the night before my job interview. This is how, you know, I'm going to say how stupid I was. Okay, I'm going to say it right now. That's how stupid I was. I've got a job interview the next day, and here I am at a party getting in a fight. So now I get home, right, and my knee is the size of a freaking grapefruit full of blood. And I've had my knee drained like, I don't know, five times, okay, and they have to drain it. There's no other way to get the blood out of there. And I'm sitting there in my bed, you know, kicked out of Cal Poly. I got a job offer from, you know, General Dynamics. I got an interview that day, and my knee is dislocated. And I'm just sitting there going, you know what? I'm just going to end it. I'm just going to take my life. I'm just going to end it. This is not worth it. And, you know, I had driven myself to that point, you know, the lowest point in my life. I don't know how else to put it. It was the lowest point in my life ever. And I was ready. I wanted, you know, I was considering just taking my life and just ending it. I was baptized Catholic, but I turned away from religion because of being Catholic and going through Catholic school turned me away from religion because the nuns were vicious, you know, and I said, these people cannot be of God. If there's a God, they're not of God. And you know, I turned away from religion, but I was still sort of spiritual, you know. And I said this, I said, God, if you exist, I want you to do these three things for me. And I know you're not supposed to ask of God. I know you're not supposed to do that, but I was desperate. And I said, fix my knee, you know, get me back into Cal Poly and get me the job at General Dynamics. And they're the most impossible things I could think of at the moment. They were the most impossible things I could think of. And I said, if you do this for me, I will never, ever question you again. I will never question your existence. I will never question you again. And, you know, I went to sleep. I woke up that morning, and the blood was gone from my knee. I don't know where it went. I really don't know where it went. The swelling had gone down. It went from the size of a large melon to the size of a small softball. Not noticeable. You know, it just looked like my knee was a little bit swollen. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. You know, I'm like, whoa. So I go to the job interview and I pass it with flying colors. They love me. Of course, they don't know that I gotten kicked out of Cal Poly. I didn't mention that, obviously. So I'm at the job interview. I go through the interview. They say, we want you. You got the job. And they go, now you got to go to the doctor because he's going to give you a health assessment. So I go to the doctor, and he makes me do squats with a dislocated knee. He didn't know my knee was dislocated because I wasn't about to tell him that it was dislocated because I didn't want to disqualify myself from the job. So I did a bunch of squats with a dislocated knee, and I looked at him and smiled and pretended it didn't hurt. And then, you know, a few days later, I get an offer letter from General Dynamics saying they're going to pay for my college. They're going to pay me $22,000 a year. They're going to give me $1,000 for every credit over 3.0 and contingent on me being in good standing at Cal Poly, you know, me being an engineer. So two of the things happened, right? All I was waiting for was the third thing. I had gotten myself kicked out of Cal Poly. And I want to say something about that, because this is something that really bothers me. You know, I had a counselor, and I don't remember his name because I don't want to remember his name, but he took pleasure in telling me that I was kicked out of the program. He took pleasure in telling me that after I went out and got 16 credits of 4.0 straight A's and got my GPA to 3.3, which would have gotten me back into the program, he took the pleasure of telling me, oh, while you were gone, the GPA was raised to 3.8, so now you can't be an electrical engineer. And I'm like, but I've already got a year. I did everything you told me to do. He's like, I'm sorry, but, you know, those are the rules. And he took pleasure in that. And I call it pulling up the ladder. You know, he pulled up the ladder. So there I was. You know, I was out of the program.
You say, oh, wait a minute, Carl. He was a – but hold it. Doesn't the dean have any say-so over that?
Brother, I didn't know who to talk to. You know, I'm – I didn't go to the dean. You know, I was just going to my counselor, and he was taking pleasure in telling me that I'm kicked out and that I can't come back. Because I said, you know, can I become an English major, which has a lower GPA, and then can I transfer to engineering? And he goes, no. He goes, once you're out of the engineering program, you're out. And I'm like – wow, you know, I was so depressed. Now you understand how depressed I was at that time.
Right,
you know,
right.
So that week, and this is the third component, Mr. Lopez, whose name I do remember, okay? I don't remember that other dude's name. I don't want to remember his name, okay? But I do remember Mr. Lopez, because he called me up that week. He was part of the Educational Opportunity Program at Cal Poly Pomona, and he called me and he said, Carlos, I got you a slot through the Educational Opportunity Program into the Electrical Engineering Program. Do you want it? And I said, do I want it? Yes. And I was back in Cal Poly, and I got the job at General Dynamics, and they paid for my undergrad, and it changed my entire life. That changed my entire life. After that, I got my master's degree at Hughes Aircraft. They paid for that. After that, I got my law degree at George Washington University, and my employer paid for that. And now I'm a patent attorney, electrical engineer, and I've earned every bit of it. I have not had anything handed to me my entire life.
Now, if that isn't a Thanksgiving Day story, I don't know what is. Boy, thanks for sharing that, man. I don't think anybody can top that one. Excellent, excellent share. Excellent share. Matter of fact, wait a minute. All right, 619-768-2945. We're here on Thanksgiving Day, planning for Thanksgiving next year, 2023. And if you guys got any comments, suggestions, ideas, just press one if you're already in the studio, or just call into that number. We're going to do a little 5-minute interlude, so you got to go to the restroom, get coffee, water, juice, stuff that turkey, whatever you got to do. We're going to play the Rural Energy Foundation, and we'll be back with Chris Collins and Carlos of Villamont.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
All right, and if Dream Hope Dream Habitat is interested in anything over in the continent, on the continent of Africa, just through my network, I know people in, let's see, most of them are in East Africa. I know maybe one solid person in West, but most of my contacts on the ground are in East Africa. But we can talk about that later. Let's go back to the phone lines here, 309-706-0111. Your mic is open.
Good and hello. I'm hoping everybody can hear me.
We can.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. My first time here. I'm in Bloomington, Illinois. I'm a friend of Chris Collins. I've known him for about, 10, 15 years. I don't know. I've been involved heavily in Hope, whether it's volunteering or assisting where I can. I'm very proud of the situation that Chris has, found himself in as far as trying to work through all the problems that he faced each day when you go to people and try to tell them that you're interested in doing things to change the world. A lot of people will say, yeah, okay, go ahead, but they don't really want to step up. But I'd like to refer to this chest analogy that was said earlier and take it a little bit further. And what I would say on top of that is that when it comes to what's going on, unless we recognize there's a game going and we know what's happening, that it's there, then we're just going to pass right by and not even realize that there is something that we're interested in that's going on. And once we decide that we recognize it, then we sit down, it becomes personal, and we become involved, and we become aware, and then that's when you start involving strategies. And unless you know the abilities and the limitations of all the pieces on the board, you can't properly have a strategy, and the pieces won't work together. And each piece is dependent upon the other to have any success. By combining pieces, you put it together a front, and you compound your power to defend yourself and to be offensive by gaining strength in numbers. And once you do that, you become less defensive and you become offensive, and then you start changing the board by using your strategies. And the game is won and lost by the moves you make and the moves you don't make. And if you don't make any moves, you're going to lose. The other team just, if you don't make any moves, guess what the other team does? It just dominates and comes and takes everything you have. And it doesn't matter if you're down to one piece, it's going to be gone no matter how powerful that piece is. And unless you make some moves, you're not involved and you're not doing anything that say that you didn't even understand what the game is about. And last thing I'll say on that is that each piece alone is very limited. And without backing each other up, like I say, there's no movement. And so I'm not going to talk too long just because I'm kind of new and I've never spoken here. I'm a little bit nervous. But I just want you guys to know.
I like everything you're saying. I love everything you're saying. Matter of fact, we got to have, because every now and then we do a live stream on chess, because everything you said is exactly right. Matter of fact, as you were speaking that, I was thinking about neighborhoods that get gentrified. A lot of times, a lot of neighborhoods get gentrified. It's because nobody who's living in the neighborhood, they don't make any moves. They just sit there and get wiped out. So I have to bring you back on that one. You're absolutely right.
Sure. But their goal, of course, is to divide us and make us weak and to make us powerless. And they can only do that if we let them, is my thoughts. And sometimes it's fear of making the wrong move, or it's the fact that you don't understand the board or things that cause us to lose. And so I don't want those things to stop us. I don't want to be lack of effort or lack of knowledge or lack of care or lack of love or even the lack of understanding humanity, in that it's not just about your little town here or your neighborhood, that this is something that's happening everywhere, and a lot of it's being hid. There's a lot of stuff that's being done in stealth where, even though that the information is there, the right people aren't spreading it. And so all of a sudden I find myself shocked by something that's been going on for like a year or something. And I'm like, how can these things be? And I've told Chris many times, goes back, I've been homeless. I've been down and out. I've been hurt. I've been falsely accused. I've been through everything. And so I'm involved because I understand what other people go through, and I just can't stand to see other people suffer. And so I just got to get involved. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you for your comment, man. I'm up here. So I had to whip out an envelope. I'm taking notes on some things that you said. Once again, anybody got any comments today? 619-768-2945. If you're already in the studio, just press 1, we'll bring you up. Chris, any comments?
I'm in a bad name, in a bad little spot with my reception, so give me a few minutes, because I don't want to break in and out on you, but I might stay clear. But definitely thank you for coming on, my friend, and I appreciated all your help and all that. And, you know, it is all about the moves that we make. You know, we're sitting here making a move right now, and I happen to be driving down the road, and I'm moving. But I want the day to be positive. You know, I'm passing mile marker 1, 2, 3, and I want to see 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and those be pieces of material getting put together and changing people's lives. You know, we have the ability. You have the ability to change what's going on this season. We're all here for a reason. And all it takes is you to just let us know to help you do. And, you know, none of you are out there alone. You know, my website is hopeforhousing.org. There's a phone number on there, 309-542-6319. You want to know any more, if you want to make any donations, you can go, there's a Cash App. It's the $34854C. We do need donations right now because we're going to the largest art festival in the world, or it's in the United States anyway, and we're getting to do a sustainable art show. I'm going to be a keynote speaker, so is Carlos. It's going to be, you know, an amazing event, but it's what we're going to be able to do to show artistry of sustainable art, disabled veterans. I've got one that's amazing. He's an author. He's a movie star. You know, he's not necessarily a star, but he's definitely been in the movie. And he's worked with the stars, and that's, he was in Life Magazine. It was one of the combat shots of him running into the field, and, you know, I got to go and help him on Veterans Day, and he gave me a call yesterday. And he asked me to come to his house because he found something that he wants me to see. He's got a surprise for me. And he had found the first book ever printed on his book. But he had ordered me one. And I thought that was it, the way he was talking. And I said, well, there's one more thing that I want you to do. He said, uh-oh, what's that? I said, I want you to sign it. But he had ordered me a book from Barnes & Noble so I could have his book. And he wanted to read a few passages to me. He said, it's going to take about 15 minutes, but I just want to share. And so he did. And if you guys know the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, well, he wrote the sequel. It was on the bestsellers to that movie in 1951. And it was The Sun Returning. And it is an amazing book. And I'd love for people to definitely get it, because it is a page turner, because it's science fiction, but it's full of the truth. And there's so many things. This man is brilliant. and I'm just very humbled to meet him. I got to help him and become his friend, and now I get to show thousands of pieces of art that he's done, and to me, that's amazing, because now everybody's going to get to share in his abilities and what he's done over his lifetime that can last our children's lifetimes, and just be put up and enjoyed, because he's even done enough research to, he's got 3-ring binders of everything every politician's ever done since 2002. Like I said, this man is a very, very smart man, and he loves to research and keep a catalog. And I'm thinking like the Smithsonian might want this, because I think it's probably the largest collection in this past 20 years. So I'll end there for now. Thank you, my friend.
All right. Getting back to the Dream Project, Carlos, now, how not the carport, but the Dream Project, how much ballpark, I think I asked this question yesterday, but I forgot the answer. How much would it cost to build one? A basic prototype.
That's a great question, Chris. We were talking about, oh, by the way, Bob, or L.A., yesterday I got into the room late, so that's why the room did go at 9 o'clock, but I got on the phone, and my ADHD brain has no track of time, like literally time doesn't exist. For me. So, but around 9 or 7,
I
finally realized
up, I showed back up around, it was after midnight. Somewhere between midnight and 12:30 and 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And you guys were still in there. So I hung in there for about 45 minutes to an hour. Just listening.
Well, it's going 24/7. This show is, you know, right now we've got at 10:30 we broadcast this show in that 24-hour room. And then at 9 p.m. we have an open mic where people can talk, you know, sort of boots on the – and that was your idea, by the way, L.A., though. You know, to have a set time where we can just go and do action stuff. So that's at 9 o'clock. But Chris was talking about the cost the other day, and I think I like the way he thinks. You know, he has his basic unit that I believe – I should probably let Chris address that. But basically, the aquaponics is like an add-on. Like he has a solar add-on that's, I think, around an extra $5,000. And I think the aquaponics add-on will also be roughly around that much. So, you know, Chris can answer the question of like an X by X, how much is it? And then if you want solar, you know, it's five, you know, X more. And if you want aquaponics, it's another 5K more. So, Chris, you want to hit that one if you're still if you can still talk?
Yeah. So like
a 10 by
12.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the 8 foot by 20 foot home with off the grid situations is $35,000, but you can have it ready to go for $30,000, not off the grid. The solar adds 5,000 to that unit.
And the aquaponics would probably add another 5,000. So you'd be looking at a $40,000 structure, and this would be out of the metal frame construction.
Yes, and one of the things I thought about, you know, was the way you said it. You know, just your mushroom, how much it's making per week on a bed of this size, you're getting 10 pounds of mushrooms. Now, if people were selling those mushrooms and they actually, you know, stepped it up and maybe got a $10,000 greenhouse situation, you can turn that in your local community into
a resource for you to have generational money coming in. That money will continue to come in because this thing continues to grow itself. And when, if you're looking at something that's, you know, $10 a pound, and you wound up scaling that and making more, now say you just went up three times, so now you're making 30 pounds of mushrooms, and that's per week, and you were able to wholesale them to the restaurant for $10. That's $300. If you had a couple of koi fish that were able to live with your others, and you look at the lifespan of that, of what it takes it to grow into an adult, that is a 100% investment to you having, you know, a retirement by selling these fish that can be growing with the ones that you're eating. Just you need to work with what needs to work together. But the koi clean it, so they do live off of what would possibly grow in a pond. That's the beautiful thing about the fish, because it's one of those cleaners. And if you were able to even help them with their microgreens and these different things, you know, they do pay by that as well. But it comes down to just working with one of the items, still having everything you need, and being able to come into a resource to help yourself make money. You know, you're talking $1,200 a month just in your mushrooms. And if you're not paying any bills, and you say you got a loan for $45,000 and you bought one of these houses, that will pay that house off and still give you the money you need to go and buy the products that you're not growing. So I wonder on that way.
You know, lots of college students, as L.A. mentioned, are now not wanting to buy gigantic houses. Like, I was just talking to my oldest son. He's an electrical engineer also from Virginia Tech. And his girlfriend is a nurse. So between both of them, you know, they could buy a big house, right? But they're actually looking at, you know, downsizing and getting, you know, a smaller house that they don't have to have a never-ending mortgage on it. You know, they can buy outright, and now they don't have a mortgage anymore. If they buy the land, you know, now they're living very sustainably. So I think a lot of the kids nowadays are actually thinking more sustainably and thinking, well, they don't have a choice actually, right? Because it isn't like, I read something in LA could probably, LA's, you're so smart, you probably researched this, you know, that supposedly this is like the first generation where the kids are worse off than the parents. Is that, I've heard that thrown around. I don't know if
you know,
it's true or not.
I've heard that too, but now with that said, and I played an audio on here either last week or earlier, no, probably last week, Lauren Nelson, who is 12 years old right now, she took a camper that she got off of, she bought it for $800, she bought it for $400, fixed it up for a total of $800 investment. That includes the purchase of the camper and the $400 fix up of the camper with labor put in by her parents, mom, dad, sister, some girlfriends, and a grandmother. But it's for her personal use. Now, there are other people on YouTube that are, you know, 13, 15, 17, that they've built their own tiny house. So my thinking on those people, that's Generation Z. So my thinking on that group of people is they looked at, you know what, their parents are like Generation X, millennial, maybe some millennials, definitely baby boomers. They're looking at, you know what, I don't want the 30-year mortgage. And you know what, I'm just going to do something where there's no mortgage at all. So now, depends on who wrote these articles. They might like a generation, a baby boomer, because there's baby boomer generation one and two. I'm part of baby boomer two. They might look at it as, because, you know, you have people by choice living in their cars, but their whole reasoning is, you know what, I don't want to pay $800 a month rent. Let me live out of my car, van, or whatever, voluntarily. And there's a lot of women doing this voluntarily. And it's, you know, and they're stacking $800 to $1,000 a month for, you know, their next move. Then you have people that are buying land by the acre. Then you have people that are buying tiny houses. And then you have, and I think these people deserve a closer look. Backpackers. You have a bunch of people that they have a backpacker or a travel logger's lifestyle. So, I mean, you have people now that are 21 years old that they've traveled to every country on the planet. I mean, every country as noted by the United Nations. That's quite a few. I've only been to 13 myself so far. So, but if you look at it, they don't have student loans. They don't have 30-year mortgages. They don't have any mortgages. And they know how to, they have a lot of social capital, and they know how to travel with their travel hacks and all that. So, you know what, it really all depends. So who's wealthier? Somebody who is debt-free, that has traveled all around the country, or somebody who's a billionaire who's saddled with debt? You know, it all depends on who you want to talk to. I want to bring somebody on right now that I want his point of view on this. A friend of mine out of the DMV, now he's a landlord, and he lived, and Mr. I'm going to call him Mr. C. Mr. C, we're going to catch you up. We're talking about sustainable housing and that type of stuff. But, Mr. C, I want to give your background. You're a landlord, and you lived in Russia. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you were over there during before the fall of the Soviet Union, or not fall, but dismantlement or dissolution, that might be a better word, of the Soviet Union. You've been in Ukraine and some other countries. How do you – well, give us your background, and then after you give that, I'm going to ask you a question.
Oh, hold on. Did I open up his mic? I got to open up his mic.
Okay. Sorry about that. All right. Mr. Connor, your mic is open now.
Okay. Yeah, I was there for the breakup, during the breakup, and after the breakup. I actually was living there and working for our government, but first couple of jobs that I had was for Department of State, and then afterwards I was working for a contractor, but it wasn't in the big cities. It was out in Siberia and in the Far East. So I was just living, I had an apartment and different apartments, because you kind of have to you might get an apartment for a few months, and then the owners, they might want to move back into the apartment, sometimes I was renting rooms, as far, I forget what the question was. What was the question?
Well, no. I wanted to give your background first, because you've lived in Russia, and then you had a business over there. You had a language school. Right.
Yeah.
And then you've been to Ukraine. Cool. Yeah, you've been to Ukraine as well.
Yeah, all the places where, like Kharkov, the Donetsk, Kiev, a lot of places, because I had to travel there for one of the jobs to recruit for educational exchanges. And we would send Ukrainians, Russians, or to the United States to study. And as for the language school, I was living in Novosibirsk. I was doing a program, well, student and professor exchanges out there. I had my own office. I was a director of that office, and you know, we did all kind of exchanges, even business exchanges and things. But on the side, I used to get a lot of people who were looking for where they could find somebody to give them English language lessons, because at the time you didn't have a lot of Americans out there, you know, or Brits or anything. You had them out there, but they were usually either students, or you had a few people who just were out there living. But there were language schools, but they were Russian run, and they would hire Russians to teach English language, or French or German. And that's really not the best way to learn. It's better to learn from a native speaker. I got the school together, not just because of that, but because of I was having problems getting visa support. Now, by the time I started working out in Siberia, I was working for a contractor of the government, and that contractor only had an official office in Moscow. They had a lot of unofficial offices all over the all over Russia, and according to the Russian government, my office didn't really technically exist, and so I had to get my visa support through the Moscow office. The Russian government only allowed people there because it was a foreign company to get 3-month visas. So I had to go into the had to budget this into my office's budget to fly back to Moscow every 3 months. And you know, you had to there before your visa has expired, or else you'd have some problems just traveling within the country. And so then get it renewed, and so that would take a few days, and then I'd have to go back to Novosibirsk. So I had a friend who said, well, you know, if you could register your office as if it could be legally registered, you could get your visa support through that office. In addition, I had 8 Russian workers, and because my that office was not legally registered, it was as though they were working just like in the United States, when you work, they take out your Social Security and they take out taxes and everything. And so after you've worked 30 years, you can retire and you get some type of a Social Security. Well, it's the same thing in Russia. So all right, I went to the person who was in charge of Moscow, to see what we could do about making my own office legal. They didn't want to. They didn't want to do it. They said it was too much trouble. And so, what I decided to do, well, I'll kill two birds with one stone. I had all these people who were wanting to learn English, and so I got myself a. I decided just to start a Russian owned nonprofit. Organization, educational organization. At the time, man, you could do that, and it was there were a lot of like Turkish companies in the area that were doing things like that, and so that was the way to go. So I did that. You know, it took a couple of months to get it together, and as I started doing it, and people. See, they already knew me anyway through the educational organization that I worked for, because I was also on TV a lot when I had to recruit for our program. I got all these people who wanted to help and all, and so once I started and I started hiring Americans and Brits who lived out there. To teach English, and I talked to this the principal at the school 162. It was like a elementary kind of middle school they thing to rent rooms there, and so ended up, long story short, had the principal on the payroll, and then. I got my workers that were working actually for that contractor that I worked for, the American contractor. I hired them so that they could get their Social Security and stuff, and then I was able to give myself visa support. So then after it was all already established, I was able to when I left the country and I come home for vacation, I would go to the consulate at in D.C., write myself up an invitation. You know, I was the president of this organization. It's called EyeSight, and I would Conrad Miller is inviting Conrad Miller for business negotiations. In Russia, and I would give myself a year long multi-entry, multi-exit visa. See, that was the other thing with the American organization that I worked for. They could could only get you a 3-month visa, and it would be one entry, one exit. So if I left the country, I had to get a whole nother visa again. So this would so the visa that I ended up getting for myself, giving myself, was one I could go in and out as many times as I wanted to in the course of that year. I mean, leave the country, come back into the country, but. But that was actually one of the main reasons. But then I contacted Simon & Schuster, the book publisher, about the books that we would be using for teaching English, and they had ones for French and German and everything like that, and so they sent me samples. Of it, and they had some good materials, so we started using that, and so it was going well pretty quickly. I mean, it took off pretty quickly. I mean, first we had like 20 students, and then we had maybe like 40 students, and then there was a lady. Elena, I forget her last name, but this was some years ago. But she was a local television personality, and she had a was like a infomercial thing that would come on the weekends. It was called Helen Video. She would highlight businesses in the area and things. And so she wanted to interview me. And so she did that. And she said, well, I could put you on every weekend if I have a son and I want him to learn French. And I did by that time we did have an actual French teacher. Because I have an apartment in Paris, and so you know we go there a lot, and eventually I would like him to go to school in Paris. But he was like 11 or 12 years old, and so you know I started doing that. Once I got on her show, just blew up. Before we knew it, I had 420 students, and I had already had to rent more rooms in school 162, and so pretty much half of that school was my school, and a lot of the most of the students who went to school 162. After they finished their school day, they would come and learn English at my school, and then a lot of the because now in all of those elementary schools there, they do want to teach English or teach foreign languages, and the foreign language teachers who were there, they took courses, so. It was getting to be extremely lucrative, and I was actually making way more than what I was making for my main job, and it was about to go to another level, but then I got approached by the husband of this other English school that was in town. See, my school was actually in the suburbs of Novosibirsk, in the academic city town. It's called Akadem Gorodok, which was kilometers outside of Novosibirsk. And this guy, he was actually connected to the mob. And, it turned out that being that popular, a lot of students from other English schools were leaving that school and going to mine. And because, once again, I had native English speakers there, and, you know, they had Russians teaching them. And so this guy, he wanted to do, like, some kind of like a joint project between our two schools and things. But pretty much he said, but, you know, and you're going to need our help because, you know, you could just disappear out here. You know, nobody would ever find you. So I got the idea. And at the time, this was actually in the 90s, early 2000s, and still, you know, the Russian mob, mafia was like, if you were to have any kind of business, you had to hook up with them and pay them for protection. And see, I didn't have that. You could have disappeared. So I pretty much quickly closed up shopping and got out of Dodge, and you know, that's all that they needed to tell me, because I up to that point
I had seen a lot of things there, like during the 90s, it wasn't unusual to see people being, you know, shot in the street, and there were a lot of mafia killings and things. There was every so often you would hear about things where you'd have two different groups of Russian mafia people who would have some kind of disagreement. One time it was between these two groups where one got so mad that they decided, well, to show the other group to send a message, they had a shoulder launch missile that they shot into that group leader's apartment and blew up the whole apartment building. And so, I mean, it was some seriously, I mean, it's really, really crazy people and stuff. So I left then. But see, by that point, I had already been in that area probably about 7 years. So, you know, I've seen a lot. And, yeah, but that's – but before that, I used to work, as I said, for Department of State in their exhibits program as a translator, an interpreter. And so I would travel in the former well, then it was the Soviet Union, the Soviet republics, in Soviet Georgia or Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and even the Baltics, and I worked there. So, but that's pretty much what my background is. But now with the money that I got in Russia, working in Russia, I was able to buy my first house here. And I was then married. Actually, I was married to a Russian lady, and we were together for about 6 years. And we broke up, and she kind of left me with a lot of bills, a lot of credit card debt. She was opening up credit cards in my name, and then running them up, and you know, I didn't know it. She had done that, and so when she left, I had like a house note and all of this credit card debt. So then what I'm around that time.
Let's start with the point that you just brought up. Now, we've got, I think Chris dropped off, but we had Carlos Villalon. He has a matter of fact, he has a club on Clubhouse called Habitat Dream Project, or it might be titled under Hope Habitat Dream House. I mean, Dream Project. Yeah. Carlos, which one is it?
It's Hope for Dream Habitat. So we partnered with Hope. We were the Dream Habitat Project, where we were trying to build tiny homes that feed people. And then Chris was doing tiny homes that feed the homeless. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, I've been homeless myself. So when I hooked up with Chris, I was very excited about that. So now we're doing tiny homes that feed and house the homeless. And it's called the project. The joint project is now called Hope for Dream Habitat Project.
All right. Well, Kyra, you need to find them on Clubhouse and join. I'm a member of it also. Now, the reason why I asked Conrad to come on is, first, Conrad's in the DMV, just like you are, Carlos. But also, Conrad, now, in your opinion, just with Carlos, because I'm trying to connect the dots here, because you've lived in Russia, you've been to Ukraine and some other places. Let's say for Russia, and then after Ukraine, after whatever happens there, it's cleared up, because there's a lot of rebuilding to go on in various parts of Ukraine. The idea of a tiny house that feeds people. That's what Carlos does. He's right there in Falls Church. How do you think that would work in Russia and Ukraine or any other countries that you've been to in Europe or Asia?
Well, yeah, well, that would work because they already have what they call dachas there. And in the spring and summer months, many Ukrainians and many Russians, they have small plots of land outside of the city, and they build little tiny houses on it, and they live in them, and they will grow their food. They're not doing it as much. Well, they will be doing it pretty soon, at least in Russia, in mass again, because of their economy is going to be totally in the Stone Age in a couple of years. So they'll be doing that, but that's something that they do anyway. And I mean, if you had some kind of now, you know, like in Ukraine, it would be very, very popular. And if you were looking for people who would to work with you, yeah, Ukrainians, they're very, very you know, they can build things. I mean, they come to this country. I mean, if you go to Baltimore, you in the area that I live in the DMV, it's a lot of Ukrainians around, and they can work with their hands. They have a lot of skills, those kind of skills like carpentry and electrical things and all. So they're very, very good at building things. And even with my rentals, I've had for many years like Ukrainian like people, carpenters and things, electricians who've helped me out. But then they moved on. Some of them have retired and all. But yeah, it would work. It would work there.
Well,
but,
now
and, but
in a place in a place like Russia. I don't know about Ukraine, but you've been over there. But is there a visible homeless the homeless visible in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg?
In
D.C.,
yeah.
you know where they are.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, in the cities.
Okay.
Yeah, you got that. You know, you got people who are have mental illness and stuff. Yeah, yeah, you have those kind of homeless people, and some other areas where it's a bit colder, you have them. But many of them, they might make themselves some little hut or something like that, and they live in it. But they do have it. But now in those countries, now it's a whole lot easier if the person is mentally ill for them to take them off the street and put them in some kind of hospital or something. So it's not like here where you have to get their consent to commit them to like a mental institution. They just go on and the person's on the street. He's looking kind of crazy. Even if he hasn't bothered anyone, really, they can do that. But then it would just take someone who would feel the need to do it. But in both places, people. You know, if you're not bothering them, if you're on the street, well, that's your business, and that's about it. But yeah, but they do have a problem.
Okay, because I, a friend of mine, she's in Ukraine. I every now and then I check, are you okay? And she told me, I guess it was within the last week or so, but it was just for a day, because she lives in Kiev, or however you pronounce it. They were without the water, electric, and internet for about 24 hours. But they have all those back now, where at least where she's at in Ukraine.
Yeah.
So that's why I brought you on there, because I'm trying to connect the dots with Dream Habitat, because it looks like it can fit basically anywhere on the planet. However,
it was definitely there. It was definitely working in Ukraine, and after the war, it's going to be anything like that. Well, housing just in general, because obviously there is not going to be housing at all, because they've destroyed everything, and then I could see people thinking about living differently instead of living in those tall apartment buildings, maybe getting small pieces of land and living more like in a smaller home, because there, both Russia and Ukraine, most of the people, they live in apartments, and these big things that, like, if you were to go someplace in this country, it would look like a project in a area of town that you wouldn't want to live in, and you would go in them and get the elevator and the smell of urine and stuff, and there's a graffiti and stuff. This is in Ukraine and in Moscow.
Let me ask you this, Conrad. Now, I've heard of the expression, probably some of the people in the audience have too. I've heard of Russian poor. What's worse, Russian poor or American or hood poor? Were they about the same? I don't know.
Russian poor would be way worse, it depends. Now, Russian poor would mean most of their food would be gotten, stuff that they grew themselves. Russians just in general are not going to have if you have a suit, in the United States, even a poor person, they may have like a suit to wear to church, and the kids might have multiple pairs of sneakers and they'll have more things to wear, but in Russia, not so much. I mean, in the last maybe 20 years, when there's been a lot of Western contact and a lot of Western products going into Russia, they've gotten a lot more things. A lot more things have been available. But that's only in the big cities. In the sticks, as far as food and clothes and obviously things like toilets and wash machines and any kind of appliances, refrigerators, they don't have that. Indoor plumbing, the places where I was staying. They had like outhouses, just like the whole town, the towns and everything. You would if he wanted water, they had a pump out on the street. You didn't have any of that in your house, and you know, in a lot of those villages and things. So if you were poor, it would be better to be poor in this country.
Okay. All right. Well, what we're going to do is going to wrap it up because we're in overtime. Thanks, Kyrie, for calling in. But like I say, Carlos, you want to give that again information where he can join your club on Clubhouse? And if Chris is there, he can give out his room as well. But anyway, Carlos, you there? You still there? All right. He might have stepped out. It is Turkey Day.
I'm still here. I was doing my while I was listening, I was doing my breath work. I was listening and actually it made the breath work easier, which is interesting. Anyways, because you know when I do breath work, I like to meditate, and you know your mind is constantly going right, but listening is easy. Then you can focus on the listening. And you don't use a lot of brain power, which is sort of interesting. Anyways, that's an aside. But yeah, you know, we're partnered with HOPE, which is the housing for the homeless. And now we've partnered and created a project called HOPE for Dream Habitat. You can find us on Clubhouse under Dream Habitat. There's also a HOPE club with Chris. But, you know, we've partnered now and we're going to be, you know, he's my Siamese twin. I love Chris very much. I've just only known him for a few days. And, you know, his actions speak for themselves. Apologize for the timer going in the back. But his actions speak for himself. So, yeah, you can find us on Dream Habitat. And he also has Chris has a club called HOPE. But we do have a room that's running 24/7. It's called HOPE for Dream Habitat on Clubhouse. And you can pop in and talk whenever you want and spread the message. You know, we're trying to do boots on the ground. We want to start building stuff, and that's what I love about Chris. You know, he's a man of action. He's doing it. And now I want to do it, and I want to build these greenhouses that feed the homeless fish, plants, and mushrooms, and we're going to do it. You know, I'm ex-military, and I will tell you one thing. I don't quit. I know Chris doesn't quit. And the only time I quit is when I'm dead. So this is going to happen one way or the other. It's going to happen.
And they have a pretty wide network. Go ahead, Conrad. I'm listening.
Yeah, I was just asking. You do greenhouses or you do regular houses too, tiny house?
Well, this is the beauty of it. Okay, I had designed a greenhouse that can grow fish, plants, and mushrooms, and then two ladies on our team. And this is interesting that you were in Russia. They're half Russian, half Ukraine, artists, architects, and now inventors, because they designed houses, buildings, and skyscrapers that will feed people organic fish, plants, and mushrooms. I designed the greenhouse, and I went to these ladies randomly. I met them on the mall at an event, and I said, I found out they're architects, and I said, would you guys be willing to design buildings? I can't pay you. You know, can you imagine how many architects would say yes? I mean, just think about it. You know, architects charge big bucks. Okay, yeah. These two ladies, artists, drew 35 drawings of houses, buildings, and skyscrapers based on my patented technology, which is technology that grows fish, plants, and mushrooms and cycles CO2 and O2 and is passive solar off-grid. You know, you can grow food with 4 feet of snow outside. Well, these ladies designed houses and buildings that can grow food with 4 feet of snow outside. But we didn't have the actual production facility. All we had was patents, ideas. These ladies are architects, so we could go to somebody and say, hey, we can build one in your backyard. This is what it's going to cost. And it's going to be, you know, conventional cost plus, right, because you're talking about a net zero building plus aquaponics. So it's going to be whatever your square footage cost is plus. And that plus is probably 1.5 to 2.0, the square footage cost to get a house that's off-grid that also grows fish, plants, and mushrooms. So Chris had the manufacturing capability because he builds houses using metal frames. So when I heard that, I said, oh, you've already got the machines that can build the houses that we're trying to build. And we were actually looking at steel construction plus rammed earth, which is a, you know, eco-friendly, basically you pack earth and it makes the Great Wall of China is made from rammed earth. It's still up. So between Chris's technology and what we're doing with rammed earth and our net zero, you know, mushroom, et cetera, we can build houses that will last thousands of years, and they're fully insulated. They can be heated up with a candle because they're fully insulated. And the front of the house is the greenhouse. That's where you have all your food. And LA knows Earthship. So it's very similar to the Earthship design, except that on the top of the thermal battery, which is this water wall, a wall full of water that acts as a thermal battery, we put an evaporative cooler on top of that. And that's what we got patented, was the concept of having an evaporative cooler inside of a passive solar structure, so that now you can cycle hot and cold air, you can cycle CO2 and O2, and you can cycle dry and moist air, which means now you can create houses that feed people off-grid. And the other interesting thing is, because the front of the house is glass, it's a solar still, which means when you put these over the water, they generate drinking water just from evaporation. When you put one of these passive solar greenhouses over salt water, the water is going to start evaporating from the sun, the heat from the sun. Because that front of the greenhouse, by the way, it'll get it. If you keep it completely sealed, you'll fry. That's how hot it gets in there. Like, we're talking like 160, you know, easily one. My greenhouse gets 110, 120, no problem, with just a bunch of air leaks that it's, you know, it's not, it's a do-it-yourself, so it's not perfectly sealed, et cetera. It still gets up into the hundreds, no problem. A fully sealed, you know, greenhouse that we're talking about, like building with rammed earth, you know, Earthship type design, steel construction, you know, that thing is going to get, you could make a sauna in it easily just by taking part of the glazing, putting a little insulated box around it, putting some gravel on the ground, throwing some water on the gravel, and you've got a solar sauna. You want to dehydrate? Anything you put in front of the greenhouse gets dehydrated because it's, you know, some solar energy. So now, Chris's manufacturing capability is giving us the ability to build these anywhere because it's made out of steel. You know, that there's machines that make this all over the world. It's used for commercial construction. So to answer your question, take your local building costs, whatever they are, and it's region by region, right? In other words, African building costs are different than Russian building costs, are different than Baltimore building costs. You get the picture, you know, but you know what it costs to build per square foot, right?
Mm-hmm.
For 1.5 to 2.0, that number, we can build buildings that feed you, house you, are hurricane-proof, are termite and fire-proof, because, you know, this rammed earth is, well, the Great Wall of China is still standing, you know. So we're talking about structures that will last a lifetime, that you can hand down to your children's children's children, and everything is recyclable. Like Chris mentions, the bricks are soil. They can become back to soil. The metal can be recycled and be back to metal. Since Chris does 100% bolt-on construction, they can be deconstructed. You know, so meeting Chris has really been the missing link of the puzzle, and we're joining his team. Okay, just to be clear, because Chris already has the nonprofit organization going. He's already got all the connections. He's got all the manufacturing, and we're just starting, you know, to get all that stuff. You know, how do you start a nonprofit? How do you get, you know, all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So Chris has really been the missing piece of the puzzle, so that now we're getting to launch a Kickstarter for the Hope for Dream Habitat project, okay? And at the beginning, before Chris, I was going to say, oh, you can buy these perks so that we can have money to build a prototype of this greenhouse that grows fish plants and mushrooms and houses people. Now the Kickstarter has been transformed to, we are taking pre-orders for these greenhouses and houses that can grow fish plants and mushrooms. So Chris is a blessing. In LA, you too. You know, Chris found you. I don't know how you found you or how you found each other.
We were on Clubhouse 7 a.m. in the morning called, what was the room? Unleash Your Potential.
413 Club. Oh, Unleash Your Potential. Okay, I know that club. There's the Unleash Your Potential Club. There's the 413 Club, early riser clubs, you know. So that's how you met. That all makes sense now. So Chris, I met Chris through the 413 Club, which is another club like Unleash Potential. And actually somebody from the club introduced me to Chris. They said, you know, there's a guy that is on your same mission. I said, really? And I talked to Chris, and we talked for like 2 hours nonstop. And he is my Siamese twin. I mean, he is my brother from another mother. He and I align on everything, like vision, scope, you name it, wealth, politics, every possible topic. We align it around, I want to say 100%. I would say 98%. It's probably 100%. You know, so we're going
Carlos,
on Basil, and we're going
Carlos,
to be, we're going to be promoting the project. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me, cause before blog talk, because we're in overtime, I don't want them to kick us off. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, Chris, we got 1 minute. I'm going to give you the last word before they boot us out.
You know, I think and love all of you, even everyone that's listening. I need all of you to understand this is the season for a change. And there is a reason, and it's for humanity. What is humane? It's okay to have your dog outside in the winter, it's against the law to have your dog outside in the winter, but it's okay to have your mother, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, grandmother, grandfather, granddaughter, grandson, your dad. That's okay. We need to ask ourselves, we are the human race. We need to stop the disgrace, the discouragement, and we are human beings, but we need to start being human. And this is an opportunity for you to be involved in every way you could possibly want to, because it's totally up to you. Everyone's different, and that's for sure. But all of us together is the cure. And have a blessed Thanksgiving. And thank you.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. You know where to go. Meet us at Clubhouse over at Dream Habitat. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day and safe rest of the holiday.
Thank you.